Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we take that pile of sources you've got, articles, research, notes, and really dig in to find the crucial stuff. We try to cut through the noise, get you properly informed, and maybe drop a surprising fact or two along the way. Today, we're diving deep into preclinical management and rescue for polytrauma patients. Just picture it: a really bad accident, someone with multiple serious injuries, and the clock, it's ticking like crazy. Before they even see the inside of a hospital, there's this whole like symphony of quick, precise actions. That's the world of preclinical management and rescue.
It really is a symphony under pressure. And that first phase, you know, it often looks chaotic. It's always intense, but it's not just about waiting for the ambulance. It's absolutely foundational. It sets the stage for everything that comes after. It's where those immediate life threats get spotted and crucially dealt with.
Right. So our mission for this deep dive is to give you a really clear picture of what goes on in those first vital moments, that golden hour, as some call it, why every second is so critical, and maybe some of the surprising things about how pre-hospital care actually works. We're pulling from your sources, looking at the core principles, the super fast assessments, the key things they do before the hospital. Okay, let's get into it. When we talk about managing these patients outside the hospital, two acronyms always pop up: PHTLS and ATLS.
Mm-hmm. Pre-hospital and advanced trauma life support.
Exactly. They're kind of the backbone, right? Mm. But ATLS, that's the one that's gone global. What's the story there? I heard it has quite an origin.
Oh, it really does. It's fascinating, actually. The ATLS program, which is, used everywhere now, it came out of a really personal tragedy. It was started by a surgeon, Dr. James Steiner, back in the late 70s. He and his family were in a plane crash, a really bad one, out in rural Nebraska. And the care his wife and kids got at the local hospital, well, pretty inadequate. That experience basically pushed him to create something structured, systematic, and, well, just better for injured people no matter where they were.
Wow. That really hits home. Puts the why behind it all. So, okay. With that motivation, what's the absolute core philosophy then? When responders arrive, what's the number one rule?
The absolute number one rule, the guiding principle, you can boil it down to four words: treat first what kills first.
Mm-hmm.
Every single thing they do out there, every quick diagnosis, every intervention, it's all driven by that urgency. Focus on what's going to kill the patient right now, even if something else looks, messier.
Treat first what kills first. Makes total sense. Real-time triage. Okay, so let's walk through the famous ABCDE sequence. We all kind of know it, but what's the tricky part about A for airway out in the field? What's the biggest challenge?
Right, A is airway. But the insight isn't just knowing the letter. It's knowing that securing it is step one in buying time, the big challenge. Doing it quickly and effectively when there might be blood, vomit, maybe facial injuries, all sorts of obstructions. You've got to ensure ventilation, get oxygen in, because, well, without oxygen, nothing else matters much. And straight away, you're also thinking about the neck inline stabilization. Usually a rigid collar goes on fast to protect the spine. That often happens almost at the same time.
Okay, so airway's job one, non-negotiable. Once that's sorted, you need to make sure they're actually breathing effectively, right? That's B. How do they check that quickly?
Yeah. Exactly. Airway open. Great. Now, are the lungs working? Getting oxygen in, CO2 out. That gas exchange deep down in the alveoli. If that's not happening, hypoxia sets in fast, lack of oxygen, and that causes damage. So pre-hospital, they'll do a quick look, feel, listen, inspect, palpate, auscultate the chest, checking for injuries like a collapsed lung, maybe bleeding inside the chest.
Okay, now C for circulation. This one always feels like the most visceral part of trauma to me, the bleeding. What are the key moves in the field for that? Why is it sometimes even more urgent than airway?
Oh, it absolutely is a race. Controlling major bleeding is huge because bleeding out exsanguination is a massive cause of preventable death. So specific injuries need specific tactics. Pelvic injury. A pelvic sling can stabilize and compress, kind of close down the space, slow the bleeding. Bad leg fracture, especially the thigh. Straightening it out, axial reduction and splinting is key. Not just for pain, but stops bone ends moving around, causing more internal bleeding. You can see the bleeding, external stuff. Pressure dressing, fast. If that's not cutting it, a tourniquet. Pre-hospital tourniquets save limbs, save lives.
Yeah, that brings up that quote from the sources, the one that jumped out at me. Watch out. If the bleeding can be seen, it must be stopped immediately. If not, get the patient to where you can quickly.
Mm.
So that implies you might actually ditch the ABC order sometimes if you see catastrophic external bleeding.
Absolutely. And that's a critical point about real-world trauma.
Yeah.
If someone is spurting blood, you don't check their airway first. You stop the bleeding. That becomes a CAB approach, or CABDE, really.
Yeah.
It's clinical judgment overriding the standard sequence because that bleed is the most immediate killer. You tackle that first, then go back to airway and breathing.
Okay, that makes sense. CAB. So once the immediate dying risks are hopefully under control, you shift to D for disability,
Yeah.
checking the brain, the spine. Why is getting that baseline neurological status so important out there before the hospital?
Precisely. After the A, B, and C are addressed, getting that neural baseline is crucial. It's a snapshot of their brain function, possible spinal cord issues. So you're doing the Glasgow Coma Scale, the GCS. That's the standard way to score how conscious they are, how responsive. You're checking their pupils. Are they equal? Do they react to light? That tells you a lot about potential brain injury. And a quick check of movement and sensation in their arms and legs gives you clues about spinal cord injury or head trauma. This info is gold for the receiving hospital.
Okay, that covers the patient-level stuff. But like you said, it's not just one person. There's a whole system behind them, right? How complex is that pre-hospital network?
Oh, it's definitely a network, and it varies a lot place to place. You've got everything from maybe untrained bystanders doing basic first aid, all the way up to highly trained paramedics, EMTs, and in some systems, you even have doctors, maybe helicopter teams, flying directly to the scene. Plus, you often have integration with other services like mountain rescue, lifeguards, depending on where you are. It's layered.
Now, one of the sources had this really striking comparison about doctors being involved in pre-hospital care in different countries. It kind of challenges what you might think is best.
Yeah.
What were those differences?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point about efficiency and resources. The data showed, for instance, Germany has doctors on scene for like 98% of major traumas, almost always.
Yeah.
Compare that to the Netherlands, where it's only about 2%, or the US, where it's basically zero direct physician response in the field from most systems. But here's the kicker. Even with all those doctors, the German patients actually spent longer on scene, about 15 minutes more, got twice the amount of IV fluids pre-hospitally. And yet, when they looked at survival after 24 hours, no difference compared to the Netherlands.
No difference. Wow.
No. It really makes you question if having a doctor on every single call is the most efficient or even necessary model. It suggests a well-trained paramedic system focused on key interventions and rapid transport can be just as effective.
That German-Dutch comparison is genuinely surprising. Really makes you think about how we design these systems. So, with these different responders, how do they figure out where to take the patient? Not every hospital can handle severe trauma, right?
Right, exactly. That's where field triage guidelines come in. In the US, the CDC has a well-known one, the Field Triage Decision Scheme. It's basically a flow chart. It guides responders through steps looking at vital signs, blood pressure, heart rate, breathing, then anatomical injuries. Do the chest get penetrated? Is there a flail chest, pelvic fracture, amputation, open skull? Then the mechanism, how did it happen? Big fall, high-speed crash, ejection, and finally, special factors. Is the patient older, say over 55? Because they do worse even with seemingly lesser injuries. Are they a child needing a pediatric center? On blood thinners? Pregnant? All these things help decide. Does this patient need a top-level trauma center, or can they go to a closer hospital? It's about matching the patient's needs to the hospital's capabilities. Right patient, right place, right time.
And then there are the times when the system itself gets overwhelmed, like a mass casualty incident, an MCI. Does treat first what kills first still apply, or does everything change?
Everything changes, really. In an MCI, you just don't have enough resources,
Yeah.
people, equipment, time to give everyone the normal level of care. So the strategy shifts dramatically. Instead of maybe doing more involved procedures on scene, it becomes about doing the absolute minimum, most essential, life-saving things for the greatest number of people. We're talking really basic airway adjuncts, like an OPA or NPA, maybe a quick tourniquet or direct pressure for bleeding. That's it. The goal becomes maximizing survival across the group, which unfortunately means patients might arrive at the hospital less stabilized than they would be from a single patient incident. It's a brutal calculation, but necessary.
Shifting gears slightly, but still crucial in those early moments, spinal precautions. That's a big part of managing high-energy trauma, isn't it? Protecting the spine.
Oh, absolutely. If someone's had a significant blunt trauma, big car crash, fall from height, you have to assume they might have an unstable spinal injury until proven otherwise, even if they seem fine neurologically at first. So, spinal precautions are all about minimizing any movement of the spine during rescue and transport. That means keeping them flat, usually on their back in a neutral position, applying that cervical collar. And anytime you have to move them, it's a coordinated log roll, keeping the head, neck, and body aligned as one unit. Prevent twisting or bending.
Okay, so keeping the spine still is key, but what about the patient experience? I know there's been some debate about using those long, hard spinal boards for everyone. What's the current thinking?
Yeah, this is where things get really interesting, actually. It shows how practice evolves. Spinal precautions, vital. But strapping everyone down tight on a hard longboard for extended periods, we're rethinking that. Concerns started mounting about the downsides. Skin breakdown, those nasty pressure sores, risk of aspiration if they vomit, lung infections, blood clots. Plus, for patients who are awake, it's just plain uncomfortable and can increase pain and anxiety. So the push now is towards early and appropriate removal of immobilization, especially the longboard. Using validated decision rules like NXUS or the Canadian C-spine rule helps crews safely clear the spine in patients who are alert, stable, and don't have neck pain or neurological symptoms. It's about being smart, not just rigid.
That's a really important shift, balancing precaution with patient comfort and other risks. Okay, let's talk about making the patient more comfortable in managing other issues. Giving drugs in the field sounds like a huge challenge.
It is a challenge, but it's also crucial. Sedation, pain relief, analgesia, and sometimes even emergency anesthesia are key parts of modern pre-hospital care. Sure, simple things like splinting a fracture or just talking to the patient can help, but a lot of trauma patients need strong pain medication, and there's a real ethical obligation to treat pain. How well pain is managed massively impacts how patients perceive their care, and it can reduce harmful stress responses. But the data shows we're not always great at it. Studies suggest less than half of trauma patients get adequate pain relief before reaching the hospital. That's a big gap.
Less than half? That's pretty shocking. What makes it so hard? Is it getting the drugs, the training, or maybe worry about side effects or hiding symptoms?
It's probably a mix of all those things. Access isn't usually the main issue in well-developed systems. It's more the complexity of giving potent drugs like opioids safely in a moving, bouncing ambulance. You need good monitoring for side effects, like slowed breathing. And yeah, there's been that historical fear of masking signs of injury, though we now know untreated severe pain is generally worse. So it comes down to having well-trained crews who are confident, have good protocols, the right equipment for monitoring, and prioritize pain relief while still assessing the patient carefully.
And what about taking it a step further, emergency anesthesia, putting someone completely under, outside the hospital? When would that ever be necessary?
Yeah, that's a big intervention. It's mainly for patients who simply cannot maintain their own airway or breathe effectively, so acute oxygenation or ventilation failure. Or if they have a severely decreased level of consciousness, like a GCS less than 9, and are at high risk of aspirating, maybe from bad head injury or because they're very unstable hemodynamically. It's not done lightly. It needs a proper assessment, getting the patient as stable as possible first, a standardized approach. And crucially, the team has to be ready for complications, like needing to perform a surgical airway if they can't get the breathing tube in normally. They'll use drugs to induce anesthesia hypnotics like propofol or etomidate, maybe midazolam, and often muscle relaxants like succinylcholine or rocuronium to make intubation easier and faster.
So these drugs are powerful tools, but you mentioned complications like succinylcholine. What kind of side effects are crews watching out for? It sounds like a real balancing act.
It absolutely is a balancing act. Succinylcholine works fast, great for intubation, but yeah, it comes with baggage. Crews are watching for heart rhythm problems. It can speed up or slow down the heart. A big one is potassium release from muscles, which in some patients can cause dangerously high potassium levels, even cardiac arrest. Also, blood pressure swings, muscle aches afterwards from the initial twitching it causes, and like any drug, allergic reactions are possible. It can also increase pressure inside the eyes and stomach. So the team has to know all this, anticipate it, and be ready to manage it instantly. It really underscores the level of training needed for advanced pre-hospital care.
Going back to B for breathing, how do they handle really serious chest injuries on the spot, like a tension pneumothorax? That sounds terrifyingly fast.
It's terrifyingly fast. A tension pneumothorax is a true emergency. Air gets into the chest space, usually from a lung injury, but can't get out. Pressure builds up, collapses the lung, shoves the heart and major blood vessels over. It messes up breathing and circulation. The patient gets acutely short of breath. You might not hear breath sounds on that side. The chest might sound hollow or boomy when you tap it, hyper-resonant. Sometimes you see neck veins bulging, but not always, especially if they're also bleeding heavily. The windpipe shifting sideways is a super late sign. You rarely see it clearly if you suspect it clinically. You don't wait for an X-ray. You decompress immediately. Stick a large needle into the chest, second intercostal space, mid-clavicular line, basically high up on the front of the chest. That lets the trapped air hiss out, converts a life-threatening tension pneumo into a civil pneumothorax, which buys time until a proper chest tube can be placed at the hospital. It's a life-saving procedure, often needed if someone with chest trauma is put on a ventilator.
Wow. Okay, this deep dive has really thrown a spotlight on just how complex and absolutely critical preclinical management and rescue is. From those rapid ABCDE assessments guided by ATLS, Understanding the surprising system differences, how strategies shift for MCIs to the really fine-tuned, high-stakes use of drugs and procedures. It's so much more than just transport. It really gives you an appreciation for the pressure those first responders are under, making life or death calls in seconds, often with limited resources.
Absolutely. And that core principle, constantly asking, treat first, what kills first? That structured approach, based on evidence, it demonstrably saves lives and prevents complications. It really shows how discipline, expertise, and following priorities can bring order to chaos and make a massive difference in those first critical minutes.
So what's the takeaway for you, the listener? I think this whole discussion highlights the incredible skill and intense pressure involved in that golden hour. And maybe it leaves us with a question to chew on. As our protocols get better, as technology advances, as we learn more from things like that German-Dutch comparison, how do we make sure that everyone, no matter where they have their accident, gets the best possible, most effective preclinical care? That feels like the ongoing challenge, doesn't it?